Judiciary Committee, February 24th, room 354.
Committee will come to order. Clerk will note those members present and balance their absence. House Bill 2206, Tony Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Anthony Barker. I'm the current chairman of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Function and Organization of the Bar. I have a brief statement in support of House Bill 2206. I don't think it's a very earth-shaking matter, but basically the amendment provides for excluding lawyers from the class of people protected by ORS 408.450. ORS 408.450 is a bill enacted during World War II to protect the status quo as to all persons licensed by any state board or commission. And it simply provides that if they are on active duty with the military services, that they do not have to pay their fees, and they will not thereby lose their right to practice their profession. We feel that the while this is appropriate during a period of national emergency, and perhaps it was also appropriate during a period when the selective service laws were in effect, that under the present circumstances with a completely volunteer military service, that there isn't any really persuasive reason why this particular protection should be extended to members of the legal profession. All officers, or all lawyers who are now receiving this waiver are officers, and they're serving in the Judge Advocate General's Corps or in comparable legal roles in the military service. There are 49 officer members of the Oregon State Bar on active duty. 40 of these are of the rank of captain or above, and would be making a salary equivalent to about $18,000, which is the approximate equivalent of what they would be making if they had the same period of active service, perhaps, as lawyers in a large firm in Portland. So I think that there isn't any real hardship involved in charging these people their dues. They get all the benefits of the membership. They receive all the publications. They can participate in all bar activities and CLE. They can vote at the annual meeting and so on. In every respect, they're entitled to the privileges of the membership, including the right to practice in the Oregon courts when they're in the state. So. And the feeling is that they would, that there would be no hardship in charging these people their annual dues, and the benefit to the bar would be approximately $5,300, which would enable them to carry on the bar activities, or to have these people pay their fair share of the cost of bar activities. If there's any questions, I would be glad to either answer them or obtain an answer for the committee.
I forgot. How much are the dues now? Second tier who've been admitted to practice for longer than whatever the cutoff.
Yeah, the top level dues are $120, and I'm not sure whether that includes the extra amount for client protection or not. There's a fund for client protection, which is an extra added amount, and I'm not sure whether $120 is includes that or not. But the range of dues is about from $83 for a first-year member to $120 for a fourth-year member.
It's a two-step thing still.
No, it's a three-step. There's a $116 charge in there, I think, which is applicable for only 1 year. Don't ask me why.
How much?
I think it goes from 83 to 116 to 120.
Representative Richards?
Did you identify what CLE means?
Oh, continuing legal education. It's just it's part of the educational procedures that are conducted through the bar office.
A monthly publication or a term?
No, it's a session where specialty of law perhaps is explained to members of the bar who wish to participate in it, and there is normally a loose leaf publication, which may be quite lengthy and fairly scholarly, and published and sold through the bar.
Thank you.
Representative Lombard.
Tony, I think that I read the bar reports on this. I think Bob Jordan had a valid point in his minority report with regards to the public policy question here and whether we should be exempting the bar alone from this requirement, or putting the bar in the position so that everybody else has the protection, but bar members who happen to be in the service somehow are going to be required to pay. Did the committee really give much thought to proposing, as Jordan perhaps suggested, that we do away with the statute entirely?
Well, we considered it briefly, and I will say we didn't consider it with any great amount of study, because the different requirements of licensing and privileges of professional practice, and the statute applies to watchmakers and all kinds of people, dentists and doctors.
Well, it applies to dentists and doctors too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and whether or not their license system is structured in the same way as the bars, I don't know, and we didn't feel as though we wanted to be making recommendations as to what other people who are licensed by state boards ought to be doing. And I would say that this does not create special privileges for the members of the bar, and
no,
it's actually the reverse.
It's the reverse.
It imposes a dues on them which they would not otherwise pay.
Chairman, is there any reason why the bar, you know, if nothing was done here, why the bar couldn't establish a special category of membership, for instance? I mean, I think there's validity to your argument that these people are granted full benefits, and particularly with regards to full privileges that they're entitled to, and bar's probably supporting them in some of these activities. Is there any reason why the bar couldn't offer a limited, almost an inactive type, or require an almost inactive type membership unless they wanted to pay for the whole thing?
Yeah. Of course, they do have the option of going inactive at the present time, so that even as to them, there wouldn't be any significant hardship, because they didn't want to be licensed as fully active members of the bar, they could go into an inactive status now.
What are the inactive fees?
$26 a year.
I would also read the, I'm not sure the bar could consistently with this statute create a special classification with no person in the military or naval service while exercising any privilege in this state by virtue of having paid an annual license or privilege fee shall lose such privilege. I don't know whether technically a sort of intermediate classification would run afoul of that statute.
I don't know either, and I think what the statute itself is not, it does not say that everybody in military service will have their professional fees waived.
No.
It simply says that they won't lose their professional status by not paying their dues or their license fee or whatever. As a practical matter, of course, it's worked out so that it operates as a waiver.
Representative Kulongowski.
Mr. Chairman, on taking up with what Mr. Lombard spoke about, I'm inclined after reading this that I think that there is a specific intent that the legislature back in World War II was trying to reach when it enacted this particular provision. And I am opposed to exempting organizations from it. Now, it would be very agreeable if you want to repeal it. But I think that the problem is that I see is this is just a foot in the door, and I think every organization is going to be coming in and wanting an exemption from the statute once somebody opens the door for them. And I'm opposed to the bill because I feel either the philosophy behind the statute is valid or it isn't, which was originally enacted. And so I don't see how you can just say the bar, and it wasn't based upon economics, the idea the guy could have, he could pay it now. I think if you have to, if you're going to do this for the Bar Association, you should look at every other licensing or professional organization and ask the same questions of whether they should be granting an exemption from it.
Further questions from the witness? Representative Rutherford?
Has this been the law since the
As far as I know, that this was the purpose of it, is that when in this period of emergency people were being drafted and so on and were volunteering for active duty and the legislature simply...
Is there some catch? Because the reason I asked that is from 1964 to 66 I was in the service and I have a distinct recollection of paying dues after having inquired of the Bar Association that they couldn't be waived. And I recall I received a letter back from the Bar saying that I did not qualify.
I think you must have corresponded with the wrong person, because to my knowledge, this has been the law, and I think that the basic underlying reason, as Representative Kulongoski says, is that to establish a protection for people during the period of the Second World War. And
well, I was what they called an obligated volunteer, and when you mentioned volunteering, struck me that maybe that was the catch, that because I had volunteered, I didn't qualify.
As far as Mr. Kulongoski's point goes, I'm sure the bar has no objection to a repeal of the statute. It's just that we didn't feel, as a member of this committee, that we knew enough about what the doctors and the dentists and the watchmakers had in mind as to whether or not that would be an appropriate recommendation for us to make.
I look upon this as sort of like the jury exemptions, you know, that the idea was everybody was going to serve on juries, and then every session somebody gets exempted, and pretty soon there's going to be nobody available to serve on juries, and I see this bill building up to the very same type vehicle.
Yeah, it could be the other way around, though, if the bill itself creates exemptions, which this exception would eliminate.
Representative Blumenauer.
Mr. Minson may be here, and if that's the case, you can...
He was, he just left.
Well,
this,
I would be glad to respond.
This kind of statute isn't mandated by some provision of federal law dealing with...
Soldiers and Relief Act.
Yeah, it doesn't flow from the way of the...
Not to my knowledge, but if that is a concern of the committee, I will be glad to inquire and send you an answer.
Would you mind checking that one point?
Okay,
sure. It doesn't flow from some federal law.
Frank? It's kind of funny to repeal one of those sometimes, but I have one, though.
Right.
Thank you. Fed's always telling us we have to.
I can't believe it.
So, all we have to do is just, may I ask the question procedurally, Mr. Chairman? If we were to, could we use 2206 just to repeal this provision?
We could, but I don't know if it would be proper for us to do it without hearings. Perhaps we could. And I'm not too interested in having 497 boards, commissions. You'd like to serve as a subcommittee of one to take the testimony that you're going to blow around.
No,
we'll come back to your point. It's a valid one, and the thought had run through my mind. The bill would permit that.
That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
House Bill 2316. Judge Beatty, Judge Dinicky, Laird Kirkpatrick, do you all want to come up together or individually? I've asked her to make the comments.
Pick them up individually.
Chairperson, members of the committee, Arnold Dennecke appearing on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Council. If they yield it to me and let me go first. I thought it really might be of some
help to the committee to know the past history of attempts at procedure reform in Oregon. We are practicing today basically under the field code, which was adopted in New York in 1848. It wasn't bad in 1848. It wasn't bad when Matthew Deedy put it into our laws, but it is rather out of date, and there have been some band-aids attached to it, but basically that's the same code that we're practicing with. Now, since, at least since I can remember, the way in which reforms were attempted were that the Oregon State Bar Committee on Practice and Procedure, a bunch of really hard-working, conscientious attorneys, would come forth with recommendations every year on various changes in the code, nothing comprehensive, but immediate problems. These would go before the Oregon State Bar, and the Oregon State Bar in convention would either adopt them or reject them. And then the Oregon State Bar would present them before the Senate and House Judiciary Committees, and sometimes they get before the full Senate and House. They met with various receptions. One thing that was always frustrating to the lawyers that were attempting to bring about reform was that the bar in convention would pass a proposal of the State Bar Committee on Practice and Procedure almost unanimously, and then some lawyer or some judge would call up one of his influential friends on one of the judiciary committees and say, that's a lousy bill, it's going to bring in the federal rules, and that's all you had to say then, it's going to bring in the federal rules, and somehow it would die, usually die in one of the judiciary committees. The other thing wrong with it, so not much happened. There was something happened. Every once in a while these things would be up four or five times, and about the fifth try, somehow they'd sneak through. But all we've got today is the field code with some patches on it. And they've been good patches, but they're still patches. Another thing wrong with it is the procedure was that the State Bar Committee, as conscientious as they were, they just never had a chance to take a comprehensive look at the whole problem. And what would happen would be that somebody would bring out the fact that our joinder statute, we hadn't even adopted the New York amendments of 1856, I think. And so somebody was, okay, they put in the joinder statute on joinder causes of action, the joinder of parties, and then they'd find out that, well, this had, well, they didn't find out, but if it went through as it did, I think, 2 or 4 years ago, this very definitely affected the part on appeals, whether all the parties to the suit had to appeal or not. I don't want to be technical, but the procedure code is such that when you tinker with one part, it very frequently affects another part. And with a committee working like the Oregon State Bar Committee or any other committee such as that, frequently that part was overlooked. So what happened? There was constant agitation for some other way of bringing this about. Now this gets a little personal, but I thought some of you might be interested. In 1973, my law clerk at that time was Leslie Roberts, who happened to be Mary Roberts' sister and Frank Roberts' daughter. And Mary was in the House then, I think, and I assure you, completely unbeknownst to me, Leslie had Mary slip a bill in giving rulemaking power to the Supreme Court. And immediately members of the bar and some of my brethren thought that I was the instigator of this and trying to grab power for the Supreme Court and give us the complete rulemaking power so that we could lay down any rules that we wanted. Some people also thought that I was an exponent of adopting the federal rules 100%, and they thought that was a pretty lousy move on my part. Actually, though, as I recall, that may have even gotten through the House. I'm not, but it sure came to an abrupt stop in the Senate.
There's a certain familiar pattern.
And I would say that most of the members of the Supreme Court, well, certainly no member of the Supreme Court, including me, felt strongly that the Supreme Court ought to have the rulemaking power. We weren't certain how we could handle it. We would have to delegate that duty to a committee composed of lawyers and judges. So when the idea came forth of having a consult on examining the code of procedure and advocating reform in whatever respects it was needed, whether it was quite overall or spotty, certainly the Supreme Court didn't oppose that. And last session, as you know, that, as I recall, got through the House and again ended in the Senate quite abruptly. You know much better than I do what the, how the Senate feels about this thing. One other observation which may be of interest to you, and it may come as a surprise to some of you, but what has really been the greatest bugaboo stopping procedural reform in Oregon for at least 25 years has been the feeling of the older, successful, influential lawyers that somehow reform meant bringing in the federal rules. And they didn't like the federal rules as they were administered in the federal district court in Oregon. My personal feeling is that the members of the bar now, over 50% of which I think are at least 50% are 35 or under, are not going to fight the federal rules, at least bringing in some parts of the federal rules. So completely aside from the wishes of this committee and the wishes of the Senate and the House, I think the bar as a whole is much more receptive to federal reform now and are not worried that somebody is going to try and put all the federal rules into action in Oregon. Thank you.
Judge, are the lawyers who used to make phone calls to the judiciary, are they still alive today? Are they in the, still in the group above 35 or practicing?
Well, at the one or two of them are alive, but I think their friends are gone from the
oh, okay. Well, that's right.
The rest are now on the bench.
Well, there's that possibility.
They still have telephones, but Representative Gardner?
I noticed it still has a $78,000 price tag on it, like appropriate $78,000. And I've got two questions regarding that. How do you plan to spend the money, if you have any plan? And secondly, how long is this council going to be in existence for?
I can answer the second part of that, and hopefully this is a continuing group. As far as the first part, I would have to yield here because I can't be of any assistance on that part.
Larry, would you like to respond to the
I have a budget attached to the back of the testimony I was going to be presenting that I was going to pass out to the committee. I can explain that.
We'll pick it up at that point. Representative Kulongoski.
Justice Denneke, I noticed that one particular on section 2 as to the members of the council, I don't know if it's by design, but I noticed the chairman of both the Senate and the House Judiciary Committees are not on that list. And as I recall, the other times I've seen a bill like that, they've always been in there. Was there a reason why that they're not put in there this time?
I was in the discussion, but I don't recall, but Judge Beatty can respond.
I can cover that now if you'd like it covered now, or I can cover it as I go through the...
The chairman, why don't you wait, Judge, because I think the party's going to form that.
That's all right. Why don't we take care of Judge Denneke first? I don't know whether he wants to leave or can you stay for a while?
I can stay for a while.
Okay, fine. Any further questions of Judge Denneke? Representative from there?
Yes. Judge, was the separation of powers issue considered at all by the committee in drafting this? I can tell you they have to address it.
Oh,
that's addressed in your
testimony. Yes, this is addressed.
I'll withdraw the question.
Further questions? What's your sequencing? Would you like to go
to
Judge Beatty?
I'm second, and then Larry for the cleanup. For the record, my name is John Beatty. I'm a circuit judge in Portland, Oregon. Yes. And the gentleman, the report which I, Mr. Bromka is distributing, I had duplicated because this is the report of my committee in 1974, and for all practical purposes, the rationale and development of this plan is set forth in it, and I think a number of the questions you have addressed in it. As the Chief Justice has said, when the bill went in the 1973 legislature, the rulemaking bill, this produced an uproar in the Judicial Conference, which met. Shortly thereafter. And as a consequence, the Judicial Conference, by vote, directed the chairman, who was then the Chief Justice, and the Executive Committee to set up a special committee of judges and lawyers to attempt to work out some way of resolving a conflict, this conflict, which has been going on in Oregon, to my knowledge, ever since I became a member of the bar here. 48, and historically, I think it goes back into the 30s. And as a result, I was made the chairman of that committee, which was instructed to bell the procedural cat in this respect. On the front page of this report, I've set forth the membership of that committee, and I think if you look at it, that you will recognize that that there are a number of the people who might very well have been participants in the phone calls here and there in past years, and a number of people who still possess a considerable amount of phone call capacity, because they're such people as Bill Gethridge and Owen Panner and Larry Dean and Tom Cooney and others. I think are well known to all of you and well known in the bar, practicing bar, on both sides. The committee was instructed to try to see what could be done to work out something which was acceptable to the to all elements of the bar and to the several courts. As a result, we went to work and met at regular intervals. I won't go into the details of how we proceeded through it, but we rapidly concluded that that it was essential to create some mechanism for continuous study and continuous recommendation, rather than attempting, as we so often do, to reinvent the wheel every time with another special committee or task force or something else, for the same reasons that the Chief Justice has all has mentioned. And we did conclude that we felt that the pattern of piecemeal change by the legislative process in procedural matters simply no longer met our needs. And we, of course, continued to have four more years of that. And I think to simply emphasize what the Chief Justice has said, even changes which are excellent in conception can create real problems if the entire functioning of the trial court and appellate court mechanism isn't considered at the time those particular proposals are made. I think I mentioned in one of the early hearings before this committee, when you were considering specific proposals by the bar and Joinder and other things, that the litigation of parties who are seeking indemnity and Joinder of multiple parties and class actions have immensely complicated the functioning of the trial courts, particularly the circuit court, without giving us in effect the kind of procedural powers which the federal court has to deal with those questions. The federal court can bypass almost all of those problems by simply instructing the parties to prepare a pretrial order, and they got to prepare one and they got to sign one. When I get a case like that, I have to, it's that complicated, I always attempt to have the parties prepare a pretrial order. And generally, if the case is so complicated and the pleadings are that thick by the time I get them, most attorneys will reach the conclusion that that's the only way out of an impossible dilemma. But sometimes they don't. I remember I had a Seattle lawyer down here once in a case with the name I won't mention, but he just flatly refused to sign a pretrial order. After they'd worked on it for 2 days, and left us with pleadings that were just in a real scramble. So that is the problem, one of the problems you get in piecemeal, attempt to do this piecemeal by the legislative process. And it also means, as a practical matter, as I think all of you recognize, that frequently a change in the legislative process, procedural change, can be dynamited by one particular individual. For reasons that may not relate to the entire procedural code as a whole. And that's just a practical thing. We all know that exists. Now, we, of course, discovered in making our study that at that time some 33 or 34 states had already vested the procedural responsibility for procedural change in the Supreme Court, giving its Supreme Court the rulemaking power. I would hazard a guess, I haven't checked it, probably three or four more that have gone that far now. So the majority of the states do this. We did not feel, partly because of our composition and partly because we trying to take a new approach. We didn't feel that we that was the only way to the future. We thought that as the Chief Justice pointed out, most Supreme Courts, when they have the rulemaking power, including the Supreme Court of the United States, in effect delegate that rulemaking power to a committee which is appointed by them. And then that committee goes through the same process that we're talking about, trying to view the thing as a whole, and comes back with recommendations to the court. Well, our conclusion was that the simplest solution is to set up a procedural council, set up that committee at the start, or council at the start, making it a permanent body, and providing that the legislature has a veto on its measures adopted, or can amend them, but that they will go into effect at a certain period after each session is over, if the legislature makes no changes. Now, the composition of the council that we developed at that time was 10 judges and 11 lawyers. Now, the first question was what sort of people do you want on it? And we were convinced unanimously that it should not be all judges and it should not be all lawyers. It ought to be a mixture. And the next question is, if you're going to have a mixture, how large do you want it? And we felt that it ought to be large enough to allow for a good deal of representation around the state because of the different problems of procedure and practice in different areas of the state. And because it's going to function on a regular basis, and a small group has problems with obtaining a quorum. We considered whether or not with respect to the balance 10 and 11, the lawyers felt that the lawyers would be happier if they had one more lawyer than the judges, and the judges didn't see that would cause a problem, so we acceded to that without any problem. We considered the question of whether there should be non-legal members or public members, and it was our conclusion that civil procedure is a highly technical matter, that it is pretty difficult for laymen to look at procedural problems and the problems of the procedural code and attempt to have an informed judgment on it. There are many areas where major policy is determined by it's entirely appropriate to have public members on it. We felt that here, this is a technical body subject to the review of the legislature, and that it would be a mistake not to confine it to people with a legal background who were lawyers. We considered also the question raised by Representative Kulongowski, whether the chairman of the Senate and House Judiciary Committee should be members or some other legislative input on this. Now, you're quite correct, Representative Kulongowski, that as the bill bounced back and forth between the House and the Senate, or the two different versions, because we started one through the House when it looked as though the Senate one was bogged down. At one point or another, both of them had the House, Senate, and House Judiciary chairman as members. And we were perfectly agreeable to whatever solution the legislature wanted to work out. As you'll see in the original committee report, we reached the conclusion that on balance it would probably be preferable not to have them. And the reason for that was that they were going to sit in judgment on it subsequently anyway, the work product. Secondly, even at that time, the number of lawyers in the legislature had decreased to a point where it appeared to us that they had an enormous number of functions to perform and increasing functions during the intervening period, the interim period. And that we just questioned whether they were going to be able to devote that much time to procedural things during the interim period. But as far as the judicial conference is concerned, and I think it's probably correct to say as far as the bar is concerned, if the legislature wishes to have legislative members, that we see no problem and would have absolutely no objection. It's entirely up to you. You can make the judgment yourself as to whether or not you think this is good.
Representative Kielengoski.
Judge, if the committee was so decided to put the chairman of both the Senate and the House Judiciary on, would you still want to work within the framework of 21 members?
I think I just add two.
Okay, just two more.
Right.
Judge, it seems to me last session that we got...
We got a justice of the peace in, too, from somewhere.
I was going to say that we got an opinion. I don't know whether it was Nate G's opinion or Hans Lindy opinion or someone, some of us consulted, which was quite unequivocal on the, in coming to a negative conclusion about the constitutionality of two members of the legislature sitting as voting members of a body of this kind.
Well.
And if I recall, it was on a separation of powers theory now. I could be mistaken in my recollection.
I have not, no one mentioned that to, at least to me, and I was representing the conference at that, in that session, and I never, in questioning in either the House presentation or the Senate, I never heard that question raised, but, so that I had never addressed myself to that problem. The legislature is going to act, Representative Hardy, on this body. If the court, I think the rationale is that the court probably has a residual inherent power to develop its own rules of procedure. And the legislature, if the legislature, as I think we note later on in this, if the legislature were to abolish all rules of civil procedure, the court could create them by rule. I think there's a common law right that goes back prior to 1776 to do that. And I don't think that the separation of powers, I'm not really startled by that. If somebody came up with a documented opinion, why, I suppose that's a problem you have to look at. But I don't see how that would really affect the constitutionality of it. I think it ought to be, you ought to be able to utilize legislative personnel on it.
Just one last question. In the different versions as they were bouncing around last session, weren't the legislative members shifted from voting to simply, sort of ex officio members?
Well, I think we described them as, they were described as ex officio, but I don't think they were, I don't remember a version which excluded a vote.
I don't either. I thought they were full voting.
If I would say in that connection that if, subject to a check, which we'll be, I'll certainly be happy to look into that question. Committee may wish to get other opinions too, but unless there are reasons for making them non-voting, I really think that when anybody's on a committee, they ought to have a vote. Now, there's something about sitting on a committee when you're a non-voting member that is just kind of frustrating, I think, to everybody. And so, if we're going to have legislative members, I would certainly urge that unless the committee concludes there's a real barrier to it, make them voting members. They're liable to show up a lot more frequently if they're voting members, I think.
An argument for or against?
Go ahead, Judge.
The quorum requirement pulling out.
The mix of the judicial membership was really worked out among the judges because the conclusion that we reached is that that most of the procedural problems, most of the complex cases occur at the trial level, and that's where procedure causes the most problems, and that it was advisable to have six circuit judges and two district judges and two appellate judges. And it was simply because of the way in which the committee viewed the focus of problems on procedure. It's the procedure in the circuit court that creates the great bulk of the problems in matters of civil procedure. The composition of the lawyer members of the council had a great deal of discussion. They ultimately wished to place them in the conclusion was to place it in the Board of Governors, which is a proportionately representative body now, and to not to try to tie the Board of Governors down too tightly with respect to their qualifications. We did provide that they had to be residents, two of them had to be residents of each of the four congressional districts. districts, of course, are roughly proportional, as I recall now, too. And we fixed the term of office at 4 years with one reappointment. We thought that was adequate. And our conclusion basically was that, as I've indicated before, that there is no problem to handling rules of procedure in this way, and the observations and by the authorities compiled by Doug Haldane, who was from the staff of the Judicial Reform Commission, which reached a similar recommendation, was that there was no constitutional barrier to handling it this way. Now, I don't recall Mr. Haldane specifically addressing the question of legislative membership, however. I may have overlooked that, but I don't recall it. I think in, I would conclude by saying that that as the Chief Justice has observed, this embodies a compromise with two very articulate sections of the bar, the trial bar, who are most concerned with civil procedure, the essentially the powerful plaintiffs group and the defense bar. And it's a compromise which is acceptable to the courts, the appellate courts, and to the circuit court, and to the district court. It was presented to the judicial conference in substantially the present form that you have it under the report which I've distributed to you. It was discussed at that time, and it was approved with one dissenting vote. And it was reaffirmed without dissent, as far as I know, in the last judicial conference for presentation it gained to the committee. So I think Mr. Kirkpatrick can address the question, perhaps questions about the, particularly the bar's point of view, and about the budget, which the bar has done some work on. And I'd be happy to respond to any other questions that you may have.
Representative Richards.
Judge Beatty, I'd like to take exception to one comment in your testimony that also appeared in the bar annual report, and that is that as a lay member of this committee, I have to weigh the question of judicial rulemaking versus the power vested in the legislature to establish that, and decide whether, as one member, how to cast my vote on the question of the establishment of this council as an alternative. And also, as a lay member of the legislature on other committees, have to weigh matters such as air particulate levels and microns and field burning smoke. And the point I want to make is that a lay person, by virtue of his lack of expertise, does not necessarily not have the ability to participate and learn and make a contribution and maybe even a fresh perspective.
I would simply say that if I think that's true, and I think it's a problem that legislatures always have when they're dealing with technical matters. The question is whether a civil procedure, a continuous civil procedure code, should have some lay members. And if I think one version added two lay members somewhere in the course of the last session, I don't think it would in any way inhibit the operation of the council to add two lay members. I think my conclusion of the committee, when we considered whether or not we ought to originally propose this with two with some lay members, was that we felt on balance that unless the particular lay members had to, were interested in the subject and people who had a concern with civil procedure, that probably would not add that much to it. But again, that's a legislative judgment, just like adding legislators. The bulk of such a committee, I think, to be practical, has to be the people who live with the procedure from day to day. And that's all I would claim for it.
I would agree.
Okay. Further questions? President Lomer.
Just curiously, talk about members of the trial bar. How are we going to determine specifically who those the trial bar? You know, I know that there are some members who do nothing but a trial practice. many other members, you have a very mixed practice of both trial practice and other practice. Is there any guidelines? Or?
Well, we ran all the way from specifying almost everything in colored hair to generalities, and then came to the conclusion, I think, without any serious objection, after we had tried to work out more precise definitions, that we'd get in more trouble by trying to be very precise than we would if we simply entrusted it to the Board of Governors, which is a representative body. And the description that we used was that the Board of Governors shall include appointments from members of the bar active in civil trial practice, to the end that the lawyer members of the council shall be broadly representative of the trial bar. Now, this left open by, as I remember the discussion, it left open the appointment of a professor, of other people who were not active in the trial bar. And but rather than specifying each individual category, we thought we would leave it to the discretion of the Board of Governors under instructions to make it broadly representative of the bar.
Any other questions?
I think that Judge Denneke should be congratulated for encapsulating the long history of the problem that we've had in this area. But I do have one question in that regard, and that is, what is to prevent this commission from becoming captive of the same group that has prevented reform all these years?
Well, I personally, I want to take part in this discussion. The fact that there were judges and lawyers from all over the state and from all branches of practice, and it's a little more difficult for the lawyer in Portland to call up a friend of his in the Senate who particularly is a lawyer and say, that's no good. It wouldn't work that way calling Burrow Green or some of the members that Judge Beatty mentioned here who are on our committee. I think it would just be more difficult to influence. I don't think it'll be impossible, and I'm sure there's going to be some lobbying like this going on. But I would hope, and I think rightly so, it would be much more difficult for a single lawyer or judge to put an end to some good reform.
I think along that line, Representative Rutherford, while I have the same misgivings personally, and much prefer the court-vested rulemaking power, I think the opposition that we've encountered in the state to it is absolutely perverse, but I don't think we get it through. And at least this mechanism, regardless of whether it becomes captive of any particular viewpoint, will force the submission of a vehicle which can be modified by the legislature itself, for that matter. But at least it sets in motion the process that it is here and there kind of reform.
I would want to make clear that I think that the worried move procedure is long overdue, and I think to recall one fellow that I went to law school with, who I think is the only one in my whole class that suffers with any rules that are worse than ours. He used to be in Rhode Island with certain forms of action. But aside from that, I think we're really in the next worst situation, and it should be changed, but I'm just concerned about having this co-opted and then passed off as reform.
Well, it's a certain, I guess there's a certain assumption here that the legislature is going to maintain some mixture of views on the point. Representative Kiligowski?
Judge, just one. Do you have a list of the members of the executive committee and the judicial conference and the advisors? Who selected those people?
They're elected. Each judicial conference elects its executive committee.
And it's specified
under bylaws.
That they be, for example, I don't remember all of them, but there's one representative of the Supreme Court, one of the Court of Appeals, one of the Juvenile Judges Association. You're speaking now of the executive committee of the...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just reading. The people who appear on Judge Beatty's list of people who put together the recommendation, who selected those individuals?
They were selected by the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference, as I recall. You know, and they were selected deliberately to get the broadest range of views among both in the bar and on the bench.
I guess the thing that I'd like to point out is that I agree with Representative Rutherford. I have a great concern about this particular bill. And if the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference is going to select the people again, I would feel much more comfortable that 11 members, the majority of the committee, is going to be selected by the bar. And I think there's just some practical reality to that, to our organization, as to who are the people that are going to make the appointments. And I am concerned very much that it does not develop into a way to stifle changes in the civil procedure system. And I am concerned very much that they do report back with some recommendations. And
well, we're going to make it mandatory. I mean, it's mandatory
now. Yeah. May I respond to that, though, by saying that it's true that the judges acceded to, in our committee, acceded to having a majority of the members of the committee be members of the bar. But I don't, as a practical matter, I don't think that any kind of a group like that ends up by being a 10-11 vote anyway, because these things have to be worked out mechanically, and I think that I think it would, you would find it quite difficult for any particular group to co-opt this thing without developing a countervailing force that would pretty clearly manifest itself, pretty quickly manifest itself. Because the judges have to live with what everybody else is proposing. And if the group is proposing something the judges feel they can't live with in their courts, they can always bring in a dissenting report to present to the legislature, and vice versa, as far as the bar is concerned, and raise that issue just clearly and squarely and in a much broader way than you can usually raise it on matters that come before this committee.
Further questions? Representative Gardner?
Just a comment. I'm not necessarily against the idea that when you talk about the legislature exercising effective oversight through this committee, I have some real problems, because I've only been here about 6 weeks. It's become very obvious to me it's a lot easier to do nothing here or to keep something from happening than it is to do something affirmative. And it seems to me that if this committee came forward with something, it automatically becomes the rules of the day 90 days after the session ends, that it would have to be a very difficult or very terrible proposal to probably push it through the legislature to really have some effective oversight. Similarly, with Representative Rutherford's comments and Representative Kulongowski's comments, that if this committee was co-opted by one particular group, that would make it even worse, because there would be that much less oversight.
Well, I think we go back, you have to go back to none of these things are impossible. The legislature gets co-opted fairly frequently. The difference is the legislature is much more susceptible to being co-opted by one or two people when it comes to procedural rules. And this has been the history over the, at least in the past 30 years that I've been aware of it. As a matter of fact, there are certain rules that never got through the legislature, certain procedural matters, until one particular senator left. It is intended that this council will produce an organized, coherent approach to civil procedure, which will be under continuous study, will be published, subject to public hearings, well in advance of the legislative session. And I think we all contemplate that, generally speaking, the legislature will probably feel that that it's safe enough to let what particular changes go through. Unless there is something that presents a major policy question that is called to their attention by members of the bar or public or something like that. I really don't think that just the way human beings work together, drawn from these disparate parts of the state and groups, I don't think it's likely that anybody can co-opt anything.
Representative Kulongowski.
Again, just to
confirm my own memory. I recall that there was another committee like this formed in about 1971 or 73 with Dean Hollis as the chairman of it. And I understand that there was an appropriation to that committee to undertake a review of the very issue that you're asking. And something that comes in the back of my mind that when his report came out, what it was for the establishment of another committee to look at it again.
I think
has there been a study taken of
the Judicial Reform Commission came out with at the same time that our committee reported and with substantially the same recommendation.
What was the charge of the Judicial Reform Committee? Do you recall?
You mean what was the Judicial Reform Commission supposed to do?
Yes.
So we're talking about Hollis.
Yeah,
that was Hollis.
The Hollis recommendations got changed by Senate Judiciary last time into what study.
The commission, the Judicial Reform Commission came to the same conclusion that we did, and we had actually Owen Tanner was a member of the commission and on our committee also, and they supported it.
Of course, the House approved this last session.
Yes.
Twice, I believe, under rather peculiar circumstances involving two different bills.
If I could just comment on that also, as I understand it, the last session, this same proposal, or essentially the same proposal, was really being pushed by four different groups, the Hollis Governor's Commission on Judicial Reform, the Oregon Judicial Conference, and then two independent committees of the Oregon State Bar, both the Procedure and the Practice Committee and the Committee on Judicial Administration, all came out with essentially the same recommendations. There were, I think, three bills introduced, and they ultimately consolidated them into two, and there was some juggling around, but the three groups decided to work together on the bill, but they all came up with essentially the same conclusion.
So the bill that was in the Senate, David, what you're telling me that I saw was actually an amendment to.
That's correct.
It was converted.
And then we brought it back. We got it back over to the House, and the House voted to approve all the Senate amendments, and all we needed was a vote in the Senate, and it disappeared the last day of the session. The committee did not meet again.
Thank you.
Chairman Lomar.
Looking at Section 3 of the bill, line 9 on page 3, it indicates the rules thus adopted shall be submitted to the Legislative Assembly, et cetera. Now, is it contemplated that these are to be submitted and adopted by the Legislative Assembly and then become part of the ORS, or is there some other procedure contemplated here? Are they taken out of the ORS?
I think it is contemplated that they would be taken out of ORS. would become rules, just like federal rules of civil procedure, in other words, in that format.
Then it's not contemplated under this Section 3 that, although they're submitted to the Legislative Assembly, that they have to be approved.
No, it's the contemplation is that they would go into effect 90 days after the end of the session unless the legislature amends or repeals or supplements.
That is the same mechanism that was in the bill last time, as we approved it twice, and it's the same, I think it's the same approach that's used generally.
That's right.
Although
one version
outside the legislature.
Right. One version in the Senate, the Senate was kicking the thing back and forth, reversed that process and required that they be submitted to the legislature for approval before adoption and created a relatively unworkable.
Well, that made it a study committee.
Yep.
It really would have made its proposal.
That's
just
correct.
A bill that would start from scratch. And, Representative Rutherford?
I was just wondering, the American Law Institute, of course, has undertaken similar projects in various fields of the law, and clearly they've not gotten bogged down in politics, and I just wondered if it was because of the different organization that was handling it, or the broader geographical basis, or whether they just had a better system for adopting it. I wondered if you'd give any consideration to that.
Well, we looked at most of the mechanisms for amending civil procedure rules, and I think we did not. No one specifically proposed that we adopt that. Of course, it's essentially a private. Those are private organizations or quasi-public organizations, not their methods. think that basically, as we saw it, this was the one way we could skin this cat. And we thought that the more we thought about it, the more we thought that it would be a workable method of doing it, because we saw ourselves as still locked into the conflict between people who wanted to retain the power to do this piecemeal year after year, and were reluctant to dead set against giving the Supreme Court the rulemaking power. And I suppose, in a sense, this worked somewhat like the American Law Institute Committee's function.
I think what they usually would do, they would take the person that they called a reporter, and invariably it was a professor of law somewhere.
Yes,
I don't know just exactly what the reporter did, but they seemed to sort of make it go, and then there was a board.
The board, however, is my constitutional law professor, who was one of those for a long time, Herbert Wexler, who's been on a number of federal commissions. But I think the power of the staff and the report in that institution was always quite great. In other words, this wasn't a grassroots operation. This was a term which is used in a term of opprobrium nowadays. It was a somewhat elitist operation, not something negotiated between grassroots practitioners, which is what really we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond?
Judge,
if I understand your question correctly, too, I think the great difference is the American Law Institute's recommendation only had to be adopted by members of the American Law Institute, and any court, any legislature could do anything or not do anything they wanted to.
Were you through, Judge Beeney?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Larry, do you want to pick up?
For the record, my name is Larry Kirkpatrick. I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. At the outset, I wanted to emphasize that it's the feeling of the bar that this is the most important of all the procedure bills that the bar is introducing at this session. We have 12 bills from our committee alone that have come down to the legislature, and I think it's the feeling of the bar committee and perhaps the bar as a whole with regard to procedure legislation that this is the best long-range solution to the problems of procedure reform in Oregon. The reason why we feel so strongly about the need for this bill is that, as has been indicated by the testimony, it has been since 1862 that there's, when the current code was adopted, that there's been any revision or major sweeping overhaul or study of the rules of civil procedure. Everything that's been done has been very limited and in a piecemeal form. In contrast, during this period of time, we've had a complete new code of criminal law, criminal procedure, probate law. We've had, in 1961, the adoption of the Uniform Commercial Code to replace all the commercial law statutes. At the 1975 legislature, we, of course, had the complete comprehensive revision of the motor vehicles laws. In the last 2 years, the Juvenile Law Revision Committee has been studying and has proposed this session of the legislature revision of the juvenile laws. The evidence rules are being undergoing study now by the Law Improvement Committee, and I understand the report will be presented to the 1979 legislature regarding the new evidence code. Yet in the opinion of many attorneys, the rules of civil procedure are far more outdated and far more in need of overhaul and review and study than many of these other areas of law that the legislature has already authorized commissions to study. As Chief Justice Denneke has indicated, the current Oregon code is based largely on the field code. And yet Oregon even didn't go as far as many of the other states in adopting the field code. For example, one major reform of the field code was the merger of law and equity. Oregon is one of a handful of states that's maintained that distinction between law and equity. So in a way, some of our rules go back even further to the rules of the common law that are centuries old. And it may be that some of these procedures that other states have rejected as archaic are still have some current validity in Oregon, but we've never had a study group sit down and examine them and decide whether they still do have current validity. As has been indicated, the the way procedural issues have been brought to the legislature has been on an ad hoc basis by different groups. Many of the proposals have come from bar committees, particularly the Procedure and Practice Committee, but other groups have introduced procedural legislation too, and are continuing to do so even at this legislature. And yet there's not much coordination between the groups introducing these types of bills. So there isn't any one group that is taking the broad view and seeing the interrelationship or the impact any one proposal may have on other areas of procedural law. So because of this, because so many reforms have been adopted in this fashion, we have a great deal of inconsistency, conflict in the existing procedural statutes, entirely apart from the need for substantive revision. As some of the comments today, we've been talking about the need for some substantive changes. Entirely apart from that, there's also a need simply to have somebody go through and change the erroneous cross-references. There are some references in there to statutes that don't even exist. There are statutes placed in different chapters with no particular reason why they're in one chapter as opposed to another. So simply as a matter of recompiling and reclassifying the existing statutes, that is a task that needs to be done apart from the need for substantive revision. As indicated, many other states, or most other states, have been able to avoid this problem that Oregon has experienced by delegating their rulemaking authority to their highest court. In the back of my testimony that I'll pass out here, I have a list of the 33 other states that have delegated rulemaking authority to their Supreme Court. Of the 17 other states or so besides Oregon that still have legislative control over rulemaking, at least 8 of those states have adopted the federal rules in toto. So it's really 10 or fewer states, in addition to Oregon, that still have this system we have of not having the federal rules, yet something controlled by the legislature that's some mix of common law, federal rules, and the field code. The Oregon proposal that is before you is unique. It does differ from the procedures indicated in the Exhibit B to my testimony that are in effect in the other jurisdictions, in that it's not simply delegating rulemaking authority to the court of last resort in the state. It is a unique mechanism with trial lawyers and trial judges as the primary members of this committee. The other way that the proposal before you is unique, or relatively unique, is that it does still provide for a very significant legislative role. Many of the states, most of the states, that have granted rulemaking authority to their Supreme Court have thereby excluded the legislature from any significant role. The legislature is not required to ratify or play any part and have any veto power over those rules promulgated by the Supreme Court. A few states do have that mechanism. And the federal courts have that mechanism. That is the rule under the federal procedure of where Congress does have veto power over the federal rules of civil procedure. And that is the mechanism that's followed here. So the legislature would still be able to be involved in the process. None of the rules would go into effect if the legislature took action to revise or disapprove or supplement them. And it's only if the legislature took no action would they go into effect as written. The reason why this model seemed attractive, apart from the fact that it keeps the legislature somewhat involved, is that it saves the legislature time with regard to uncontroversial provisions. And most procedural proposals are relatively uncontroversial. It's a matter of cleaning up procedures. If there are particularly controversial provisions, perhaps pertaining to class actions or interrogatories, as this committee knows, it does tend to generate some degree of controversy, the particularly controversial proposals could still come back, and if the legislature felt the need to referee the controversy regarding those types of issues, it still would have power to do so. And of course, the legislature would always retain the ultimate power to simply abolish the council. If it wasn't working, if it did get captured by a particular group, if it was not performing its function effectively, the legislature could abolish the council at any time. And of course, the legislature could ignore the council if the council wasn't moving fast enough. If the legislature felt there was a need for reform beyond what the council had submitted, the legislature would retain the full power that it has now to simply go ahead and go beyond what the council had recommended and enact more sweeping procedural reform than the council itself recommended. So it doesn't dilute the legislature's power in any significant way, but it does provide a mechanism to have coordinated study of the problem and staff help to draft the best possible legislation in this area and to have careful and deliberate consideration of procedural reform proposals. The bar feels that this procedure could save a considerable amount of money in terms of litigation costs in this state. Whenever you have antiquated or archaic or unnecessarily technical procedures, it means that many litigants do not even have their case reach the merits. Many cases are disposed of entirely on procedural grounds, and in the opinion of many attorneys, that happens more in Oregon than in most other states, where cases are decided on procedural grounds rather than the merits in certain types of circumstances. And because of the uncertainties and somewhat technical nature of certain Oregon rules, a considerable amount of time is spent by attorneys on procedural matters, perhaps more than in some other states. Yet if simply 1 hour a year of the attorney's time, each attorney's time in this state were saved, 5,000 attorneys, which we have. If you just say 1 hour of attorney time by greater efficiencies in the rules or eliminating some area of uncertainty, 5,000 attorney time times $30 an hour would be $150,000 of saved time each year just from a procedural reform that would save 1 hour of time. If you assume that 1 hour a month of attorney time or 10 hours a year, let's say, we're talking about $1.5 million of litigation costs or attorney's time that would be saved if a council could improve the procedures to that extent. I don't think in any way that's an unrealistic goal to shoot for, that there could be substantial economies put into effect. And that here I'm just making reference to attorney time. This doesn't even count the court time that would be saved in terms of having to rule on motions over disputed issues of procedure, uncertainties or ambiguities in the existing procedural code. So I think the bar feels that this is, in a very substantial sense, a consumer protection measure, that it could very significantly reduce the cost of litigation, it could reduce the expenditure of valuable court time, and simply make the procedural operation of the Oregon court system of higher quality and lower cost. And this is why the Oregon State Bar very strongly recommends the adoption of a Council on Civil Procedures.
Representative Gardner.
This $78,000 that you have for the next biennium, would you anticipate that would be a continuing expense per biennium on in the future for some indefinite period of time?
I believe that it would, although it seems to me that the greatest expenditure would be needed at the first biennium. I mean, it seems to me that at the beginning there's a need simply to go through, put statutes, related statutes in the same chapter rather than different chapters, and simply go through and do some of this form organization that I mentioned apart from the substance. So once the statutes were cleaned up, it might be that there'd be a need for fewer meetings and less staff help when the main role of the council was simply to review new procedural proposals that were being made. So I think it is possible that the cost of the council would decline somewhat over a period of time. The budget that is being proposed, this is not a rigid budget, but the budget is attached to the back of my testimony. It contemplates the possibility of a half-time attorney, either a half-time attorney of high stature or perhaps a more junior attorney of full-time or three-fourths time. It simply allocates a certain amount of salary that the council can make the decision on how much attorney time to purchase with that salary, and also contemplates a half-time secretary. This is an extremely modest proposal in terms of funding compared to the other law revision committees, commissions that have been established. I haven't been able to get the exact figures for the criminal law revision or the criminal procedure revision, but I know they're substantially higher than this proposal. The juvenile law revision committee of the last 2 years has had a budget much larger than the $78,000. So $78,000, if anything, is too modest, but the bar did feel, and the judicial conference did feel, that a substantial amount of could be done with that staff help and with the amount of volunteer attorney and judge time that would be available to work on these proposals.
Do you have any experience or knowledge of the costs that these other states have turned the rulemaking authority over to the Supreme Court of incurred?
I don't have any figures on that. We could attempt to get those for the committee if you would like. I think Judge Beatty's comments are correct, that most of the states that have a rulemaking authority in their appellate court, they simply have gotten a group of attorneys and law professors and so forth to do the actual assembling of the rules, and I don't know how much of that help is volunteer and to what extent they have budgets through the court systems in those states to support the council, but we could attempt to gather some of that.
Representative Brummer.
Larry, a couple of questions. One, I just want to make sure I understand the bill. Effectively, you'd only be having new rules made on a biennial basis,
that's
as
correct.
I read the bill, because it would have to be laid before the Legislative Assembly.
That's correct.
Okay. Second question is, I'm curious about the language in line 7 of page 3. It talks about not abridging, enlarging, or modifying the substantive rights of any litigant. I'm accustomed to seeing rigid distinctions drawn between procedure and substance, and I really question whether those lines are valid or not, and I wonder whether language of that kind could ever be adhered to. For example, a change in a rule of discovery could act to the benefit of defendants generally, let's say, or plaintiffs generally, at least one could make a case of that kind. And likewise, another rule could act to the benefit of defendants generally. Does it make any sense to have a phrase like substance?
exploratory advice to the committee not to overstep the bounds?
Well, I think that was, I think the intent was certainly to confine the council to procedural rulemaking. Your point is an excellent one, that it's very difficult to draw that line, although it does have to be drawn in other circumstances. For example, the retroactive effect of legislation, you know, talking about procedural laws being retroactive, but substantive laws not being. And so courts often have to wrestle with that difficulty, and as I understand it, some of the other states that do have rulemaking authority have had to deal with some of those questions. What is a procedural reform, and what is a reform of the substantive rights of parties? And it's a difficult question, but I'm not sure it's not a line that needs to be stated somewhere in the legislation. Perhaps Judge Beatty or Chief Justice Denneke have additional comments on that.
That's the reason it was in there, to allay the fears of people that thought, well, they'll come in and start monkeying around with the substantive law.
I think there's something to be said in legislation for stating its purpose and for also stating what it's not intended to do as well as what it is intended to do, particularly when you've got as many sensitive people looking at it as you have with something like this. I think it's there for a specific purpose. Obviously the thing can function without it, but...
I guess what sparked the question is, would be able to find someone going to the Supreme Court on an appeal saying that a particular rule promulgated by this body affects the substantive rights of a client, and therefore the case ought to be reversed, Your Honor, because the whole rule was invalid, even though the...
I anticipate there will be, and I anticipate that the Supreme Court ought to be able to decide the question properly, as they do in most cases. That's inevitable. If we, no matter what is done in something like this, the distinction between procedure and substance is going to be raised. It will give, in one or two cases, it will give the court an opportunity to interpret the thing, and I think if there is some language there, I don't see it as hurting, and I think it is assisting the court in that, making that decision.
Last question. Could someone provide us with the memo that Doug Haldane apparently did on the constitutionality of separation of powers? The thing that really concerns me is the appointment power. It's not merely that it's separate branches of government, but it's in specified subdivisions to those branches of government. We designate the executive committee and the district judges, designate the board of governors. And so you have three different appointing authorities. And quite apart from the separation of powers issue, I wonder whether there's any further possible defect or problem.
I will look for, I got the files back from Bill Dale, who succeeded me, and I sent all my files to him, and I've got the files down in the office, and I'll go through those and see if I can find Doug's memo. If I can't, well, I'll try to track him down.
He's down there.
I'll check with him on that.
See if he's got a copy of it, and I'll look for it.
I'm almost certain he doesn't, because I obtained his entire file from him, and it wasn't in there. I do have the report, the full report that he drafted for the governor's commission, which I'd be happy to introduce here, but it doesn't have anything about the constitutionality.
Yeah, I drafted the committee report with Haldane's memoranda in front of me, so it's somewhere around. We'll find it.
Did his memoranda address this specific appointed structure?
His memoranda addresses the question of whether primarily of the scope of the power of the courts to include non-judicial people in the process of making the decision, the inclusion of lawyers as well as judges in the rulemaking process, and how it fits into the case. And he discusses two or three cases in New York and some other places. But I'll see if I can find a memo to get it to you.
Representative Rutherford?
Back of the budget, did you anticipate that you would have a lot of equipment lent to you and things of that nature? What did you plan to put the officers in, Salem or Portland or Gene?
No. Decisions were made about that, really. The discussion that I understand took place at the last session about this contemplated that perhaps a part-time attorney would be hired, or a faculty member, somebody that had an office and wasn't working full-time for the commission, and perhaps would have access to other office space, but it was felt that it was desirable to leave this fairly general because the council might want full-time help for a while and then cut back, or they might want to get a particular person and only hire them on a half-time basis. But it was hoped that there might be donated office space from attorneys or from some other sort that might help avoid the necessity of spending this very limited amount of money on too much equipment.
The reason I raise it, it does seem very modest. Not the $78,000 is modest, but when you start looking at the secretary, I take it as a half-time secretary.
Yes, that would be.
But $100 a month for office equipment seems awfully reasonable.
Well, what we did when we worked, for one thing, we were both the bar and the judicial conference were so concerned with this bill that we were prepared to make it fly if we couldn't get any money at all. And I think people on the committee know, the lawyers are involved in bar committees anyway, in which they contribute their own time and their own expenses. And there's no expense to utilizing judges. And we figured if we had to put this together without any kind of centralized facility, we'd do it. So I think that one possible solution is to have it function out of the bar office. Another possible function would be to have it function out of the court administrator's office. The thing could be put together with a modest budget and kept there, and on relatively starvation wages, I think. The legislature is satisfied it's going to work.
Further questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Before we adjourn, I had submitted a copy of 2316 to Joyce Cresswell, who has been doing some work with the committee as an intern, just to give a person somewhat removed from the subject matter a chance to react. Joyce has prepared a little memo. I don't know if all the members of the committee have it yet. We'll see that it's distributed. But while she's here, Joyce, could you come up and just give us any comments you have?
Still a little nervous following that triumphant. My main concern with the bill was that we're not delegating this authority to the Supreme Court. We're delegating it to some court members and some lay people. And so my objections to the bill lie in the delegation without sufficient standards or safeguards to make sure that the interests of people who really care about the amendments to the code are represented. So what I would do is rewrite major portions of the bill to include basic APA protections, such that the committee or the council would operate like a mini legislature, rather than removing itself almost entirely from the legislative process. So in the memo, I have pointed out the different APA procedures and protections that I would include. I think it's important to realize that if people aren't ready for the federal rules, we can't take a group of 21 people and set them aside and let them make the federal rules. So I would definitely look into the delegation question and make sure that there are standards sufficient to ensure that people will be heard before the changes are actually made.
Now, are you talking about procedural standards for the conduct of the business of the council?
Yeah.
In shaping,
right.
Preparing,
yeah,
the proposal?
See, I would allow the council to make its own, to set its own procedures, but that first meeting at which they do so, I think should be open to great debate. And so I would provide that APA procedures would apply at that first meeting, so that notice is out and that people would be able to come and give their input on how they think that that council should work. I would also...
Excuse me. Representative Plummer.
Joyce, you mean the procedures that the council itself adopts for itself, or do you mean hearings that the council has on proposed rules that it will be laying before the legislature?
I think I would... A little bit of both. This can't be an APA. This is not an agency, and the APA wouldn't apply across the board. But I think all agencies, when they set up their procedures, are required to hold a public hearing before they do so. So I think at that first step, that bottom level, we should have an APA hearing to let lawyers who are interested in the council come and give input on how they think the council should work. Whether they want a full-time secretary or a half-time secretary, I think is important. when it comes to the interim hearings that the council will be having, I think APA protections there are also important. Just to get notice out, let people know that the hearing is coming up. Those things just are not specified in the bill. It says public hearing, but it doesn't specify notice, what the topic will be, and the basics of an APA hearing. Also, the bill proposes to submit the rules to the legislature, but that's all it says. It doesn't say what happens once they get in. And I would propose that the bills be, by this act, required to be, or the rules to be published as bills and made available for public inspection, as any other bill would be in the legislative process. Then if a certain number of people requested a hearing on the bill, showed interest in the bill, then I would expect this act to say that the legislature is required to hold a hearing on the bill. Those sorts of things, those basic standards, just don't seem to be implied in this language, and they're certainly not explicit. And I think probably the only other major comment I would make would be to require the council to report on its changes, the changes it makes, and any changes promulgated and passed by the legislature, if the legislature chose to do so. As it stands, I think CLE puts out a report at the end of each session. That's all volunteer work, and I'm sure the people who are called upon to do it tend to be pretty busy. And I would like to see something in Oregon law that requires this kind of publication to let people know what's going on in the legislature, because I know it's very difficult to keep up with civil procedure changes. As a practicing attorney, I'm sure that everyone tries, but those sorts of things often are difficult to understand without getting in on all the debate. And the last thing I think I would change would be just, I think I'd put a Section 7 in my draft, which would guarantee that the operations of the council won't preclude pleading and practice amendments through the traditional legislative process. Now that may be the antithesis of what the drafters want. But again, I can't see delegating all the pleading and practice amending power away from the legislature. I understand that it's perfectly feasible to do it to the Supreme Court, but we're not giving the power to them. We're giving the power to a different body altogether. And I would prefer that attorneys who felt they couldn't reach the council in any way felt comfortable to go to the legislature with their own procedural amendments and approach the legislature on that level. And that creates a problem with the rules on the one hand and the law on the other hand. And I'm not sure how you resolve that.
Well, I don't think it was the intention of this proposal to oust the legislature from the power to make mm-hmm. civil procedural rules in the usual fashion. Mm-hmm. And I think the reference to supplementing the rules was intended to indicate that we're not purporting to divest ourselves of that mm-hmm. power, but it perhaps bears clearing up. And appreciate your mentioning it.
Then there are some other minor changes, wording changes. I thought that a couple of sections were very unclear, and I've changed those were noted in the memo. Other than that, I think that's my basic objection is the delegation problem.
Thank you. Question, Joyce? Yeah, thank you guys. Very helpful. Okay. Any further comments or questions on 2316?
Do the committee members have a fiscal impact statement?
Mine is.
Okay. Kay Hutchinson from the fiscal office just came up, and a fiscal impact statement has been prepared. And I'm not, is this the same statement that you sent out?
That's the same one that was sent to the people.
Okay, did you have any comments you want to add?
Well, all I can add is that...
Do you want to come up to the microphone?
Yeah. Okay, Hutchinson from the Legislative Fiscal Office. I would just add that I've basically taken the Oregon State Bar's recommendations on what they would intend to do with the money that they, the money figure that they put into the budget or into the bill. I think that depending on how many meetings and where they're located, the funds are probably adequate to do what they want. The variable would be the meetings, their locations, and numbers. If there are any questions you have, I'll try to answer them.
I'm not sure it's an aspect of this that our committee ought to go into too deeply. The bill clears this committee. I assume that's going to be considered at length and ways and means. I would only say the one meeting a month struck me as perhaps a little conservative in terms of the first biennium's operation of this group. But perhaps that. Yeah, one a month, that doesn't really matter. So, anyway, thank you. No further discussion on 2316. Before we adjourn, I have a requested bill for committee introduction. It's back to the Senate inadvertently. But it would authorize LC 2306. It would authorize counties to increase marriage license fee with proceeds to be used for marriage conciliation services. And it would be shown at the request of Jay Fulberg and Dr. Stanley Cohen. And I say that both Jay and Dr. Cohen are in some way connected with I think they are one or both have that connection, but they also have some connection with the family conciliation services operation in Multnomah County.
Tax on new marriages to help one get a
increases the fiscal impact, increases the thought more people might give to getting married.
You claim discrimination, Mark?
Mark and I have
Representative Blumenauer moves the chair be authorized to introduce the committee bill at the request of Jay Fulberg and Dr. Stanley Cohen. Any objection?
Mark and I have a bill we'd like to introduce for a portion of the bond.
Okay, where's the trial marriage bill? Isn't that ready?
I have it, Mr. Chairman, if the committee, Drew Davis is going to bring it up.
He wrapped the gavel. We can talk about it.
I'm going to put it on the minute.
Further business before the committee. Adjourn until 1:30 tomorrow. Are you two of bright,
shining stars in the
Representative Wiry over there?
No, Clancho.
Okay.
We'll bring it up.